Robert Smigel is a longtime comedian and filmmaker who, as a writer, has been making audiences laugh going all the way back to the mid-1980s when he joined the SNL Writers' Room. In that time, he has been an instrumental part in a number of shows over the years that include serving as Conan O'Brien's first head writer. He is the brains behind Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, Ace and Gary on SNL, and a whole lot more. He also wrote, directed, and wrote the movies for the recent Netflix animation Leo that has received rave reviews and a ton of views on the streaming service. And he's actually going to be at South by Southwest this weekend doing a couple of really cool things, taking part in two different panel discussions. One is on Friday, March 8th. It is Creating Comedy from the Director's Chair at Esther's Follies alongside Judd Apatow and Frank Oz. And on Saturday, March 9th from 10 to 11:15, he's going to be back at Esther's Follies with his old buddy Conan, the origins of whatever you call what we did with Conan O'Brien and Robert Smigel. Go to sxsw.com for info, possibly snag yourself a badge or tickets to either of those events. Robert, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
Very good. Nice to see you.
So you're taking part in a couple of really cool panel discussions at South by Southwest on Friday and Saturday night.
Yep.
Have you had a chance to spend much time in Austin, Robert?
I've been to Texas, but not Austin. Been to Houston, I covered Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke's campaigns a couple of years ago. And I guess it's almost 6 years ago. And that was sort of the Texas. And I also went to a convention. I went to the Republican convention back in the 90s, actually, the one that was in Houston.
How did that go?
Pat Buchanan made one of the creepiest speeches I've ever heard at a convention. Google that speech and it'll send a chill through your bones.
Robert, you and I share a love for the Windy City. You lived in Chicago.
Okay, good. Let's get into
there to pursue
Chicago politics. No, I'm kidding.
Let's talk a little Rahm Emanuel and the legacy of the Pritzkers and so many other people in that city. No, you and I both lived in Chicago at seminal moments in our adulthoods.
Oh, yeah.
We moved there for improv before ultimately landing that SNL gig. I lived there for 6.5 years in my early to mid 30s, and it was huge in my development as a human. You call your time in Chicago before getting that SNL writer's job one of the happiest times in your life. Why do you cherish that time in the Windy City so much in the early to mid 1980s?
Well, and by the way, when were you there? In the 2000s or so?
I was there from 2009 all the way until early 2015. So I got the city at a great time.
What was special about that specific time? And then I promise I'll answer your question. I'm just curious.
So I feel like some of the dangerous elements of the city had really subsided, and it was a place
everything's gone to crap since the pandemic in terms of
I met my wife there. I got to work for WGN Radio. I took a writing class at Second City, and it's just a place that I love the food, the people, and I really got comfortable in my own skin as a result of just getting to learn more about and understand how to maneuver this beautiful city. And so
that's amazing. That's great. Yeah. I love Chicago for all those reasons. And there's something about when they say Midwestern values, like Midwesterners are, deceptively smart, and they are, there's sort of a, I grew up in New York City. So, and I loved doing, when I was a little kid, I loved it. I thought it was the coolest growing up in Manhattan and the kind of Martin Scorsese era of like the mean streets. It was kind of, then it started to get gentrified and a little more homogenous. And by the time I was like in my late teens, disco was a thing, and everybody started like, getting very, I just started getting aware of like how self, how New York was just kind of, everybody was starting to like emulate Woody Allen, not the funny part of Woody Allen, but the like pretentious, kind of pseudo intellectual side of the people in his movies that, you know, he was attempting to parody most of the time, but people kind of just wanted to be that. It was sort of the same way people misunderstood Saturday Night Fever, which was supposed to be like kind of an attack on that lifestyle and the shallowness of it. And it ended up glamorizing disco because the songs were so good. And anyway, I was like ready for something else by the time I was like in college. And Chicago was like an accident. I was a bad student in college trying to be a dentist because my dad was a successful dentist. And then I ran into Tim Kazurinsky, who was a cast member at SNL, and he told me about the Second City courses, Players Workshop. And so I was so tired of trying to be, I was so disillusioned because I was doing so badly that I took a crack at Chicago for a summer. That was the plan, just a summer. And
It's a good time to move there.
it is a good time. It's a good sell. There's no city better in the summer than Chicago, that's for sure.
Yep.
But I love the energy. I love the lack of pretension among the people. And there's something about, you know, the people are still ambitious there, but they're more, it's a, more of a human scale. I think there's a friend of mine from that area said that people are just generally more content with their lives, with just being alive in general. And New York is just kind of this petri dish of ambition, and probably LA too, to some degree. And Lorne Michaels used to always say, Chicago, it's about the work. It's not about where you're going to end up. It's about the work. And so he always respected, you know, that kind of Second City ideal. And that's how it felt there. And yes, they were the best times of my life, other than once I had kids, because I just met like-minded people, comedy-wise at least, and I joined somebody's comedy group, and we had a lot of success. And I was sort of, I just felt like I wasn't making a lot of money, but I was making enough to like pay for my apartment. I was sharing it with a couple of guys in the group, and it was enough. It was like amazing that I didn't have to have a regular gig. That's how successful our show was. We made like 27, we netted like $2,700 a weekend, and we split it. And that was like way more than enough to sustain me, because it was just really cheap to live in that area. And
What area?
it was Lincoln Park, which is more
Okay.
expensive now.
Yeah.
This was sort of pre-gentrification Chicago, but it was still a very nice area. It had the same kind of feel that like Queens and Brooklyn do now in Manhattan, in New York, where I love that Chicago was just that you can live in hip neighborhoods that weren't like skyscraper ridden, like you did in Manhattan at the time. There was no Brooklyn scene, or any scene other than in Manhattan, and it was just kind of suffocating at times to live in that environment. And so I liked the slower pace, and I thought there's just more than enough culture in Chicago, and I like the sports teams. Fans better. I went to a Cubs game like the first weekend I was there, and I just went up to the box office and like, just what's your best seat right now? We got something right behind the dugout. And I was like, what? This isn't New York at all. That would never happen. And it probably, again, things have changed. The town's just like every city got more gentrified. Could never do that now, but this was in the 80s. So I'm sitting behind the dugout watching the Cubs play Cincinnati, and Tom Seaver, who was my favorite Met. I grew up as a Met fan, and I'm like fascinated that the people who seem to be having the best time were in the bleachers. They're all the way in the shitty seats behind right field and left field, and they're chanting, right field sucks, right field sucks, left field sucks. And I'm like, and they're throwing the home run ball back. Chicagoans invented all that stuff. There's just like a, so there's something to that too. There's a sense of humor to that part of the country that doesn't exist the same, quite the same way in places like New York and LA, maybe because there's like a lack of intensity in Chicago that allows people to have a little more perspective and be funny in a different way. And I was just charmed by the whole place. I really was, just loved it. And I would live there if I could make a living there. I would, but the work has been on either coast, and plus I have an autistic son, so that kind of dictated. I live in New Jersey now, but that dictated a lot of our choices as well.
Understandable. So you do move back to New York for the 85-86 season of SNL, and just looking at those episodes, I want to say it was like 3 or 4 episodes in, John Lithgow hosted, and I bring this up because there is a sketch in that episode that I think is one of the underrated SNL sketches of all time. And I'm curious if you had a hand in it, because you've been so good at anthropomorphizing animals over the years. It was John Lithgow as a priest, and he is in confession, and it's a bunch of dogs going through the confession.
Oh, Did you have a hand in that one at all? No, that was Whitney Brown wrote that.
Okay.
Dogs confessing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, live animals on Saturday Night Live are always a killer. I remember a few years earlier, there was this sketch called I Married a Monkey. Do you remember that? That was Tim Kazurinsky, the guy who introduced me to Second City. That was his most famous sketch. And he just played it real straight, like he was married to a monkey, and he would just have these arguments with the monkey, and the monkey would just do whatever the monkey did, and he would improvise off of it. It was, live animals. The one that really influenced me was Toonsis.
Oh, Jack Handy. The driving cat. Heck yeah.
Yeah, Jack Handy wrote that. And the part that really got me, and I was delighted by it for a number of reasons. I had always been obsessed, like you say, with animals, and particularly anthropomorphization and the whole idea of like, the gap between what animals really think about and the stuff humans try to, you know, project onto them sometimes. And not to be condescending toward animals, I have 2 dogs and I love them to the end of the earth. But one time, so in Chicago, I used to do this thing that I wrote as a sketch for SNL. One of my friends had a cat named Thomason, and I would sing a theme song, like a Thomason the cat, like a really excited theme song. And my friend Doug would play the piano, and it would be like a theme song to a TV show with all these, you know, hijinks in store. And then theme song would end, and Doug would just keep playing the theme song, and we would just laugh because the cat does absolutely nothing but sit there. And I tried to make that a sketch, but then Jack came up with Toonsis, which was a way better way of expressing the same thing. Like, hey, this cat can drive a car. Isn't it amazing? And of course the cat sucks because he's a cat. And it was so simple and beautifully executed. But the thing that really got me was the opening credits, because in the opening credits, he didn't use a puppet. He used a real cat. And he would place this cat behind the wheel, you know, and I would watch this. This attempt to pre-tape. This was the opening segment of the thing, which was a pre-tape, a roll-in, as it were. And it took so long to get it right that I was just hypnotized. I ran upstairs to the 17th floor and recorded it, because it was on the NBC feed. Because I wanted to watch this. I wanted to have it forever. It made me laugh so hard. Just trying to place the cat in this chair, 2 fake paws on either side of him. I could have watched that for hours. And so, yeah, so later on when I came up with Triumph, definitely, you know, the paw with the microphone was kind of an extension of the Toonsis thing. And it just opened up, like, you know, like I said, Triumph, the way I would have Triumph interact with live animals was my favorite thing, you know, just cracked me up so much, the idea of animals being in a comedy sketch and having no idea that, you know, that they were being so funny.
Yeah, God, there are a handful of sketches from that era of SNL that are still just burned in my brain all these years later. Toonses, and of course, if a cat's behind the wheel, it's going to end in a horrific accident, and then you get that happy jingle that ends thing. Massive Head Wound Harry is another one.
And ooh, of course, yeah.
Yes, and then, of course, something that you've talked about a ton over the years, and that is your role in the DaBears sketch. And it's really cool to hear that you guys had a lot of fun with that around the city of Chicago, too, after it gained in popularity. But what was it like watching someone as brilliant as Chris Farley go through the motions of faking that heart attack? Maybe the all-time great physical comedian to go along with being underrated in terms of his comedic mind, too. I mean, what was it like sitting right there as that was happening?
Well, you know, I couldn't. You're in the moment, so you're not like taking in. It's funny because Chris was like, and I think I was too in general, like one of the people who really took the time to appreciate where I was. Like, I never really got over it. And I think I've told some people that I think I was maybe the first fanboy, SNL fanboy ever hired. Because like the first 5 years of the show, those were people who, you know, they're just starting the show. They're in their 20s and 30s. And then the Ebersol years, probably still people who were like, you know, when the show started, they were probably 20 at least. But I was like 14 or something like that. I was like in eighth or ninth grade. And the show just had such a huge effect on me when I was a kid. I just never missed it. And I was, and that was the era when the show with the original cast, like where everybody's Saturday night parties would stop and people would watch the show. It was that important to the culture at that time. That was a common thing across the country, but even more so in Manhattan, because SNL, you know, this was a shitty time for Manhattan and for New York City in general. Like I said, I love the grime of the Marty Scorsese New York that I grew up in, but, you know, like people were deserting the show business, especially like the Tonight Show. Johnny Carson left. There used to be a lot of shows like in the 50s and 60s that were produced in New York City, and they were, you know, New York was basically abandoned for California. And so for Saturday Night Live to be the coolest show on television and start with Live from New York and this montage of New York City is no small thing. It was like, to somebody who lived there and loved the city as a kid, it was really exciting to see that. And Lorne Michaels, you know, he's, you know, they got a, someday they got a name 49th Street after him, for the Rockefeller, you know, the street right between where the building is, where 30 Rock is. They've got to do that, because like I he's just had such a positive effect on New York City. I actually looked into it at one point. I called whatever landmark commissioner, whoever's in charge of that, and then I find out that you have to be dead for 5 years before. So hopefully it won't be for many years before that happens. But anyway, I got way off topic. What was your question?
I don't remember. It doesn't matter at this point. Speaking of Lorne, we've heard people asking over these last few years, because Lorne turns 80 this year. Like, is Lorne close to leaving SNL? If and when that happens, Robert, Do you think the show is better off just ending, or should it it continue on with somebody else at leadership? And would you consider that sort of leadership role, considering your acumen in this world and beyond?
Well, I think I'm too old for the job. I don't think they'd want to hire somebody who's like in their early 60s at this point.
Yeah.
But thank you for even mentioning that. I never wanted to run that show. That was something Lauren kind of offered me to do, what Steve Higgins ended up doing. Back in like 1994, 95, I had left to do Conan, and I decided to do the Dana Carvey show instead, because I was excited about starting something new. You know, SNL was thrilling to be a part of. And then I ended up going back after Carvey failed and doing cartoons there, which was an incredible job. But I never really wanted to. I'm always interested in like starting new stuff, you know. And rather than like continuing something that I love that somebody else already came up with. I don't know. That's my creative ego at work, I guess. I think, I don't think Lauren would want this show to end. The show's too important. I think Steve Higgins would do a fine job. You know, I mean, nobody's going to really do what Lauren does, but I think, Lauren has set a template, created a template at every aspect of the show. But hopefully it's moot, and that Lauren will, you know, I'm hoping and kind of believing that Lauren will keep doing it for as long as he feels up to it. And I think he's still more than up to it and doing a great job.
There are two things that I'm most curious about from your time as serving as Conan's first head writer. Yeah. One has to do with the Triumph sketch where you go mess with the Star Wars nerds before the premiere. Truly one of the greatest moments in television history. I'm not saying that histrionically either. It was that brilliant. But within that sketch, you're messing with these people. And I love, by the way, how you would always make sure that people were cool with having their balls busted before doing so. But within that sketch, you speak with the guy dressed up as Darth Vader at one point, and you deliver this line that I think you realize in the moment how hilarious this line is, because you kind of crack for a second, and then you say something.
I laugh
about
a lot.
The buttons on his chest, and whether one of those is to call his mom to pick him up. For you, as somebody who has delivered so many hilarious lines over the years, is that still one of your favorites here in 2024?
Not only that, but it's the line that by far is quoted back to me by fans of everything Triumph's ever said. That specific line is the most quoted Triumph line as far as I can tell. And it is a great moment. And, I mean, what I love about that Star Wars bit is, what I love so much about it is how funny everybody else is. Like, you know, I do a lot of these things, and we know there've been tons of funny Triumph remotes, but I think what makes that one so special is how funny the straight men are.
Yeah.
And I love that they were all good sports. It was sort of interesting, like, because you're right. I know it makes for good television sometimes, and it's compelling when I piss people off. And when I, you know, go after people that everybody's angry at. But for me personally, I don't get a lot of joy out of that. I get the most joy when I can make fun of people who can take it. And in that case, those kids were, a lot of them, there was a big overlap with these nerdy kids with being fans of Conan and the Conan show and Triumph by extension. And so a large percentage of the kids knew who Triumph was and were excited to be made fun of. And that was a great feeling. And it just took a lot of stress away for me. It's like when I met Don Rickles. I was a producer at Conan, and Don Rickles was a guest. And, you know, he takes one look at me and he says, "Hello, Rabbi." And I was just overjoyed. Then I found out that that's a line that John Stewart, he said the exact same thing to John Stewart when he met John Stewart.
Ah, man, you hate to have the curtain raised up like
no,
that.
No, that's okay. Cool, that's okay. You. It's you do what you can. And people should know that if they don't know already, but I try to let people know that I don't write every joke that Triumph says. I go to these remotes with writers.
Yeah.
And we write jokes in advance, and then sometimes writers come up with jokes on the spot. So, you know, hey, we're all just, if it makes people laugh, I don't care how it happens.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned Dom Rickles, because he was in maybe Norm MacDonald's finest movie, Dirty Work, a great cameo in that film. And one of my favorite
also
moments,
Norm MacDonald's only movie, coincidentally.
Yeah, fair, true enough. One of my favorite moments as a broadcaster was making Norm laugh for a conversation that I conducted for WGN Radio. It had to do with the Steelers' terrible towel, and Ben Roethlisberger was going through his sexual assault stuff then, and I said something. I don't remember the setup, so I'm just going to butcher this right now, but something having to do with the rapeless burger, terrible towel. And Norm laughed, and I'm like, holy cow, you are like my comedic icon. I can't believe I just got you to chuckle even for just a second or two. I find myself all these years later, Robert, going back and watching, it's maybe once a month or once every couple of months, going and watching Norm saving interviews on late night talk shows. And he did most of that great work on Conan. Do you have a favorite Norm MacDonald memory from your time with that show too?
Well, I wasn't there, but the moth joke is my favorite Norm moment on the Conan show. And it's, you, if you haven't seen it, it's on YouTube. Norm is telling this really corny old joke, but he spends way, way too much time before he gets to the punchline. And he's like expanding it into this Kafka-esque or Dostoevsky. I don't know. He was a big fan of Russian literature. And he was, anyway, Norm spends way too much time on this Dostoevskian expansion of a joke that ends up having a really corny punchline, but he tells it as if it's a story, and it's absolutely hysterical. And I've probably set it up too much at this point too. So the less I say, the better. But yes, Norm. So you made Norm laugh using the word rape.
Ben Roethlisberger. I knew he was a big sports fan. So the
Roethlisberger.
Roethlisberger, terrible towel. Yeah. The Roethlisberger towel, I think was the punchline. I don't remember the specifics, but
saying the word rape is like tickling Norm.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Or calling Andy Richter gay, I guess. One of those two things.
Oh my God. I was going to do a joke. I was on Seth Meyers, and I was going to do a joke about, and I was going to do it in Norm's voice, because it was, we were talking about how, he keeps losing to John Oliver every year. Everybody does. This was right after they had lost the Emmys again to John Oliver. And I said, and I was going to do it in Norm, but some people, they're classy enough that they, if they've won too many of these things, they stop submitting themselves for consideration. You know who used to do that? Bill Cosby. Here's a class act. And then it was going to go on in Norm's voice, like, then again, I suppose if the award for best comedy series hadn't been a statue, but instead was a chance to rape a young lady in her sleep, maybe old Bill might not have been quite as gracious. Might have even bribed the judges. I guess we'll never know. On account of it is a statue, not the other thing. If you're offended by that joke and you're listening, blame Norm MacDonald.
I like how you took it that last line further too, because that's classic Norm right there. Well done.
Thank you. I like you, was a huge fan and a student of Norm's comedy. He was the best.
Robert, for someone who's been making people laugh for, gosh, more than 40 years now, do you feel like it's much more difficult to do comedy in 2024 than back in the early to mid-1980s?
I mean, it's interesting because, like, I don't know, like a lot of the things that I may have done back then that I wouldn't do now, I'm not as interested in doing, because I kind of, it was like sowing my wild comedy oats, doing all those, all those bits where I was kind of, what's the expression? Touching the stove or something, where I
It's the
would,
whole Kid Icarus deal where it's how close can you fly to the sun without your wax wings melting and you plummeting back to Earth?
And it was like kind of a sport for me when I was, a kid writing these things, and then I kind of did it, I had a puppet that had sex with live animals. I mean, there's not much more you're going to be interested in once you've cracked that code.
Yeah.
And I had superheroes that everyone was obsessed with their sexuality. And man, lots of things. I'm going back to like when I wrote the nude beach sketch with Conan and Greg Daniels back in 1990 or something. I had been on a vacation with my future wife, and we happened upon a nude beach, and we were walking a public beach in Saint Martin, and we just walked and walked, and we just landed on a nude beach, never been to one before, and like this dude's just being really friendly and telling us about, restaurants we could go to and shit, and all I'm thinking about is that he's, I have a live dick in front of me. And then I just start imagining that this conversation would be all about his dick. And like, yeah, no, you know what's a great restaurant? Le Champs de Tau. It's if you make a left, if you make a left at my dick, and then and just I just wanted everything to be about his dick. Okay, thank you, and thank your dick for all your advice. All right, maybe I'll run into your dick again. And so that ended up being a fun sketch to write. And that was like sort of where the dam broke, because I hadn't really done that kind of stuff on SNL. And the first time I submitted it to the table read, it was rejected by the standards department. And then, like over the summer, the standards department was dissolved at NBC. This was the time when basic cable was starting to get big, and the networks were starting to realize that they need to compete with these other shows on basic cable and HBO that were pushing the envelope. And the 90s was just a crazy time where the dam really burst and things went too far in the opposite direction. There has been like a correction to some degree, like things like people doing blackface, and they never tried to do it in a way that invoked blackface, but it was blackface. Like, Daryl Hammond did a killer Jesse Jackson impression when he auditioned, so SNL really wanted him to do it, so they gave him like a tan kind of thing, and they thought that'd be all right. But if you watched it now, you'd probably have a problem with it.
Yeah,
And
the craziest example of that is Jimmy Kimmel doing Karl Malone, who, by the way, Karl Malone is not a good human being. But the fact that he was able to do that, I remember thinking back then, like,
yeah,
holy cow, I can't believe he's doing this right now.
no, I know. That actually, like, there were other things that I was completely okay with at the time and complicit in at times, but I was a little thrown by the blackface, because I remember that we didn't really do that in the SNL era. Excuse me, in the 80s era. It just felt like, although Billy Crystal did it, he did Sammy Davis Jr. in like 1985. Yeah, he did, like right the year before I got there. But it was just something that we weren't doing, and I assumed there was, that was like, okay, that's not, nobody's going to do that anymore. And then it came back, and I don't know, the 90s were nuts. People were doing like, handicap comedy, in Living Color. There was a very famous handicap
Handyman.
character.
Yeah.
Yeah. And And I would go to parties and people would do impressions of like Corky and think it was edgy, you know, Corky from the, what was that show? My
Life Goes On.
Life Goes On. Yeah, that was like a thing. And that was another one that I was like, even it seems hard to believe, but I had like, there were lines that I didn't enjoy crossing. And one of them was making fun of people who just, it's beyond their control. What the whatever it is their issue might be, and whether it be somebody who's handicapped on some level, you know, if they're or somebody who's addicted, who has a serious addiction problem. I didn't like doing that. Didn't like making fun of women's looks. Men fine, but women felt like they just have to deal with so much bullshit. You know, although when I was younger, before I sort of arrived at that, I did like, you know, it didn't stop me when I was younger, like in the early 90s, from like having Chris Farley play Carney Wilson or something like that.
Oh, God.
Well, I mean, that's a long SNL trip. You know, John Belushi played Elizabeth Taylor. This was not like we were, you know, putting out something new. This was just like, these were ingrained kind of traditional comedy moves. And I just feel like, as long as you understand now that you wouldn't do it, then, you know, I didn't get like why people felt like they had to attack Jimmy Fallon for his Chris Rock impression 20 years later. You know, it's like, there's no way he would do that now.
Yeah.
He didn't need to I didn't need to hear him apologize to know that, because nobody would do it now. But it was a time when SNL was okay with it. And, you know, that was another, like, Jimmy did an incredible Chris Rock impression, probably in his audition. And they probably felt like, okay, we got to get this on the air. And the audience laughed their asses off. But that was 20 years ago. You know, people have evolved and been conditioned to understand now that it's not cool to evoke something that's, you know, so hurtful. You know, and when people say, oh, come on, it's a different context, it's like, then what I do is like, okay, well, if it were some kind of imagery from the Holocaust, would it bother me even if the intent was to show that this is like wrong, or that it's not meant to, you know, you could justify it in different ways. And, but if it triggers something uncomfortable, then you have to respect that.
It's interesting. Has there ever been a Holocaust sketch on SNL? Cause I feel like if there's a show that could pull it off, it would be that show.
Good question. I mean, I think like when Mel Brooks used to do Holocaust stuff, it was always like punching up. It was making fun of Hitler and you know, the hierarchy that, you know, like Larry David got a lot of shit doing a Holocaust joke in his stand-up act on SNL.
But that's so ridiculous.
I thought it was, I didn't think it was, because he was the punchline, he was the target of that joke.
Exactly.
You know, so that felt like, come on. And I think, and you know, and it blew over. He didn't, you know, people, there was like a burst of protest, and then everybody was like, no.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of times it's a vocal minority, and if you don't kowtow to the pitchforks and torches and just say, look,
sometimes
like
that is the case, and sometimes it is true that Twitter isn't necessarily the world. And and then there's stuff that I'll defend, like, I don't know, you know, people talk about Blazing Saddles and how, oh, it's couldn't make that now, and you know, but Richard Pryor was like a co-writer of that, and it's like the most progressive anti-racism, anti-bigotry comedy of that decade, or many decades.
People say that about about Tropic Thunder also that you couldn't make that movie. I'm like, you're completely missing the point if you don't think so. That was satirizing the ridiculousness of Hollywood. As a matter of fact, I heard you on another podcast talk about how going to see Blazing Saddles in the theater is one of the first memories you have of just laughing gutturally and wanting to do that for a living. And you actually got to tell Mel Brooks that too. How cool was that for you?
It was great. It's always great when you can express something that personal and special to the person responsible for it. And yes, it was the moment when the church choir sings, "Our town is turning into shit." Just took me so by surprise at that moment. And I just, it was one of those moments where, like, you never forget it because you don't remember ever laughing that hard up to that point in your life. I mean, everything's case by case, and in the case of Blazing Saddles, it's a good argument for, like, sometimes intent should matter, you know.
Could Blazing Saddles be made in 2024?
No, not a chance. Not the part where everybody throws the N-word around. I mean, I don't see how. I mean, I don't know. It's like, you know, only it's like Jews aren't only Jews would be allowed to make any kind of Holocaust jokes, just like only Black people would be allowed to toss that word around. So, you know, there's probably a universe where you can see a movie with those words. But that's got to be, you know, it's got to come from the people who are comfortable hearing it and saying it to each other. They don't want to hear it from people who aren't Black.
I'm in a weird gray area with the Holocaust stuff, because believe it or not, Robert, I'm more Armenian than anything. So we went through our own version of Holocaust in the early 1900s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We are, in a lot of ways, the poor man's Jew. So I'm like, do I have access to, like, the A version of that versus the ER version of the Holocaust jokes?
I haven't seen any comedy about the Armenian genocide. Did you ever see Conan's trip to Armenia?
No.
Oh, my God. I can't believe it. You're not... If you are, you've got to see this. So, you know, Conan does these shows where he travels to a different country. They're all on YouTube, I'm sure. You've got to watch the Armenia special. It's incredible. It's him and Sona, his assistant. You know who I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Sona's Armenian. So he goes to Armenia with Sona, and it's a very sweet and very funny show, but it ends at a memorial site that is, a memorial site for the Armenian genocide, and it becomes very serious but amazing.
You are the father of three sons, I believe. Got a 9 and 7-year-old at home. What do you think the biggest challenge is for parents in 2024, Robert?
Wow. Okay.
It's a loaded question with a lot of different avenues you can go down.
Well, it really sucks that movies don't exist anymore. Because when my kids were young, I would take them to the movies all the time. It's just a great way to get out of the house and feel like you're going on a joint adventure with your kids, showing them something really interesting and entertaining and expanding their minds. And that practically doesn't exist anymore.
You literally have one option most weeks, one option. And so you watch that one option. That's it for you for like 3 or 4 weeks after that.
You're talking about one movie option?
Yeah, one movie option that's like acceptable for kids.
Right, but at least they used to be in theaters, and now, like, even the animated movies aren't all opening in theaters. My movie didn't open in a theater.
In retrospect, that was a huge mistake, and I know Netflix was responsible for that film. That movie needed the movie theater treatment.
Well, I don't think they'd necessarily agree, because it broke all their records. in terms of viewership, but I enjoyed watching it in a movie theater. All our screenings were fantastic. Getting to hear little kids laugh at the Don't Cry song is one of the highlights of my whole career. I just it's probably my favorite part of the whole movie. And everybody was worried, like, oh, is this a bad message? Blah, 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 telling kids not to cry. But of course, it's ameliorated at the end when the girl laughs at him and makes fun of the advice. But on the way there, people were like, how are people going to take this? So I watched this movie in a theater with these audience of parents and their kids, and Don't Cry comes on, and he starts singing Cryings for Weaklings. Don't cry, it's lazy and dumb. And the little kids start laughing their asses off. It was so satisfying.
Hell yeah.
They understood at the age of 6 or 7 that they were watching a cliche being turned on its ear. It was such a beautiful thing to see confirmation that, because I'm always fighting for that argument that the audience is smarter than you give them credit for. You got to stay ahead of the audience. You don't pander to them. And in this case, it's 6 and 7 year old kids that are proving this argument, like beyond my expectation even. And I'm telling you, it was like they're laughing harder at that than any other part of the movie. And then the song would get like spontaneous applause at the end. The song that everyone was worried about ended up being, one of the highlights of the movie, partly because kids are just way smarter than we give them credit for. But again, I would never have discovered that except for getting to watch it in a theater with a bunch of kids. And I just think I feel bad, especially that both kids' movies and comedies are just not happening in movie theaters anymore. Like we talk about Blazing Saddles, talk about so many comedies I got to watch growing up in movie theaters and going on that ride all the way to like The Hangover, first Hangover. I mean, I don't know if you saw it with a big crowd, but if you did, it's you don't forget an experience like that because you're like going on a ride with people. It's like literally going on a exciting roller coaster ride. And there are that many laughs in a movie that smart. And I had so many experiences like that, starting with, Woody Allen movies, going all the way to pretty much The Hangover. And that was like the last one, I think, where I was in a theater and everybody was laughing because comedy started biting the dust sooner than animated movies did in theaters. I thought animated movies would be the last frontier, but it's not. It's action movies and Sydney Sweeney romantic comedies, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's something about Mary and Old School also did that to me in the movie
Oh
theater.
my
I really
God, there's
wish.
something about Mary was such a great experience in a theater.
Brilliant. Yeah, you're right about that. It was
Just the
necessary to
close-up
see
of
that in
the
the theater
zipper,
for the
and
first time.
the close-up of his zipper from it just you just
How'd you get
hearing
the bean
that
above the Frank? Yeah,
moving.
that whole scene is crazy, including getting to see a little bit of flesh there before it's all said and done.
It's such a gift that's been, I feel bad for my kids that they're being deprived of that. They just watch movies at home and they, I played them super bad and they really enjoyed it, but it's not the same as getting to see a comedy and now they're not even making them anymore because it's like what's left? It's like now you have to go to like a talk show or a stand-up act to experience that kind of shared laughter.
I think you're going to see a resurgence of that type of film. It's not going to be as prevalent as it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, but I think we will see a comeback sooner rather than later. I just wish I could have gone back and seen the Woody Allen film, Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex, but Were Afraid to Ask, just for the act where Gene Wilder is courting a sheep.
A sheep.
Oh, yeah. It's one of my all-time favorite, gosh, 20 to 30 minute stretches in a film.
Yeah, that was special. I think the biggest laugh I ever heard in a movie theater was Rob Reiner's mom. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
When Harry Met Sally, which is not my favorite comedy, but it's very good. It's very
Yeah.
funny. And Meg Ryan simulates an orgasm in the middle of the deli, and then the woman next at the next table is approached by a waitress, and I'll have what she's having. And he gave the line to his mom, which was so sweet. His mom delivers the line that gets the biggest laugh of any laugh I've ever heard in a movie theater.
Wait, that was his mom that delivered that line?
Estelle Reiner, Carl Reiner's wife,
Oh,
Rob
wow.
Reiner's mom. Yeah.
Oh, man, that is crazy. All right, you're a big sports fan. I assume you're still anti-wave. I am as well. Do you get as much amusement as I do out of family singing YMCA at sporting events? This song that's all about going to the Y to find other dudes to hook up with. I love the irony of that.
I absolutely love that. At Yankee games, that's a big Yankee thing. The grounds crew acts it out, YMCA. And people go nuts for it. I mean, it is an incredible song. I
Very
loved
catchy.
it. I remember when it came out and I loved it. And I didn't care what it was about particularly. And then I thought it was funny. It ended up making me laugh that that's what it was about. I love when, songs can be subversive like that and sneak their way into the mainstream. But the fact that like all these years later, yes, it's hysterical when it's at sporting events and people go shit house for it.
People can check you out if they have South by Southwest badges. It's going to be March 8th, which is Friday night from 10 to 11:15. Creating comedy from the director's chair that you are doing along with Judd
Judd.
Apatow. Frank Oz is going to be a part of
Yeah, I
that
can't wait to hear him. Yeah, Frank
panel
Oz.
discussion. Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. And then on Saturday, you and your old friend Conan are getting together or a panel discussion called The Origins of Whatever You Call What We Did with Conan and Robert. That is at Esther's Follies on
Yes.
Saturday night from 10 to 11:15. Both are going to be.
We're going to show clips of stuff we worked on together before the Conan show. Yeah, like rare things that some of which you haven't seen, some of which you may have, like the Adam West Lookwell show. We'll show a little bit of that and some things that'll just totally surprise you. I also want to plug, I'm going to drop a Triumph special. That's too fancy a word for it, but I taped a show at Sketchfest in San Francisco that I really liked. It wasn't particularly professionally taped, but I think it was very funny. It had Rob Schneider and Weird Al Yankovic and other celebrities as well, like dropping in.
Or you at the Castro or something, and people are just coming on stage
Yes.
and
Yeah, we were at the Castro. No, it was a game show called Let's Make a Poop that Triumph has done before. But this was a particularly special edition because of Weird Al Yankovic's presence, and you'll understand when you see it. But I'm gonna drop that on Triumph's YouTube channel very soon. And yeah, and I also might have a video coming out after the Oscars that I can't even talk about. It's just a surprise, ridiculous video.
Is it red carpet? Triumph on the red
No,
carpet?
it's not a Triumph related thing. It
Oh,
has more
okay.
to do with the movie Leo, actually.
Oh, excellent. Where does
Yeah.
Triumph stay when he's not on your hand, by the way?
I just keep Triumph in a bag somewhere. I don't give him a, he's not like he's not under plexiglass or anything like that.
Just on a side table somewhere or in a box.
Somewhere on a bag on a side table. Oh yeah, I need Triumph. Let me get him.
If Triumph were to say something to me right now, is there an idea that you have in your head that he would bust my chops about?
Well, he'd probably go after your hair.
Yeah. I'm a 46-year-old man with a faux hawk. That's a
Yeah.
good starting point.
I'm gonna give you next time I'm gonna come back with Triumph and I'll have 10 46-year-old man with faux hawk jokes for you.
Well, Robert, man, this has been a real honor. Thank you so much for the time today. We went well over the allotted time, so I appreciate you being a good sport about that.
I guess we did. Well, I enjoyed it.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. Thanks to you for hanging out. For more of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. Talk to you next time on Books on Pod.